Welcome to the first episode of Doctors and Science. I'm sitting here together with my good friend Jan Goetermoet.
Hello Bart, good morning.
All right. And myself, I'm Bart van den Kieboom. Actually, this is a special request podcast. We had a lot of our friends who were listening to the original podcast on which this podcast is based, Doctors en Wetenschappen. It's a podcast in Dutch, Belgium based. But a lot of our friends are living abroad and they said this is a very nice initiative. It's a podcast where we talk about medical sciences, interesting people who have something to say about medical sciences. You wanted to add something?
Yeah, healthcare leaders that we will invite regularly.
And we are doing that in Dutch, and they said, like, hey, this is something that we really would like to understand. But we found out that, to our great astonishment, that 99.9% of the human population doesn't speak Dutch. So this is a special request, and we are doing now our first podcast in English. And together with us, we have Professor Edgar Eekman. He was also a guest in our Dutch podcast, but we thought it was such an interesting podcast that we invited him to do this again with us, and this time in English.
Hello.
Hello, Edgar. Nice to have you here again.
It's a pleasure.
Let me introduce you first for our audience. So you have a background in communication sciences. That were your studies.
Yes.
Yeah. You have worked as a communication responsible for the Red Cross.
Yes, indeed. And as a communication consultant.
Yep. A journalist also.
A journalist, yeah. In an advertising agency.
Okay.
Yes.
That's marketing and communication.
And working in university hospital for 15 years now.
Yeah. At UZ in Brussels.
Indeed. Yes.
The university.
And spokesperson of the hospital.
Yeah, indeed. You also written a lot of books about communication in general in the healthcare industry and how the healthcare industry should, well, communicate, if I could say like that. And you also, in your doctorate, you've written about the influence of the internet on patients.
Yeah.
And from that, based on that doctorate, you got interested in something very specific that is called patient empowerment, and that's what we want to talk about today.
Yeah.
So maybe you could give us a small introduction to what is patient empowerment.
Well, I could summarize it by saying that it goes without saying that what a caregiver does in a care organization is offer the patient the best medical treatment possible, the best biomedical treatment possible.
Mm-hmm.
The result of my analysis is that caregivers have to take care of another aspect, and that is to try to restore the sense of control or autonomy of a patient. Mm-hmm. Because research shows that losing the feeling of control, losing autonomy, mm-hmm. makes people unhappy, makes people sick even, creates frustration, aggression, stress. And that's a kind of complementary effect of being sick,
mm-hmm.
that we can partly avoid. You cannot exclude it, every loss of control, because nobody has control over everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you can try to involve the patient that much that he knows what happens to him, that he understands what happens to him, that he has a sense of control to minimize that aspect of being sick as much as possible. So losing control is a side effect of being sick. What does patient empowerment do is trying to restore the sense of control. That is it, summarized.
Okay, well, but is this a job for the patient or for the doctor?
Both. You know, what I would like to challenge you, mm-hmm. Bart, Jan, and the listener, is to have a different look on the patient-caregiver relationship.
Mm-hmm.
For long, when you read scientific literature, mm-hmm. the patient-caregiver and certainly the patient-medical-doctor relationship is characterized by the fact that there is power. It's considered a power relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about power, we see power very often in a very classical sense.
Yeah.
Power as domination,
or
coercion.
Hierarchical. Yeah,
yeah, I can make you do something that you wouldn't have done otherwise, and that you will do even if you resist against it. That is the classic definition of power.
And I have to say, Edgar, I was really surprised when I read your book, because I'm a medical doctor myself, And I never thought about that I would have power over a patient.
Yeah.
So the concept of thinking in this in a power relation or hierarchical, I think, not even for me, but also many other doctors, this is a surprise. I think most doctors don't see themselves in such a position.
No, certainly not. And I agree with you. Certainly not if you consider the classic definition of power. Because the conclusion of my study is the classic definition is not applicable on average in the patient-doctor relationship, because there is no domination. There is domination in certain exceptional situations, but on average, there is even a friendly relationship. So there is power, but what I analyzed is that I identified an other form of power. And that is important because that, again, is something that is not identified by doctors. And that is power that is the result of dependence, mm-hmm. which means that what the classical definition of power also means is that someone has the intention to exercise power. And I totally agree with you, Jan. Usually there are exceptions, but doctors are not exercising intentionally power. The power, even if it's domination, is a side effect most of the time. But that other form of power, the power resulting in the fact that the patient becomes dependent, that is something that is very important that caregivers, not just doctors, the medical doctors, that caregivers are aware of.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that this is also a dependence of certain types of diseases of severity. Is there a difference between a broken leg and a malignant tumor, for instance?
Yes. What I did is I've applied a theory, and I'm more interested in the practical consequences of the theory than the theory. I don't want to make it too theoretical, but it's a very interesting theoretical subject that is applicable not just on healthcare. And that is that the dependence exists based on the dependence of resources. A doctor possesses a number of resources that may be important and sometimes are rare, may be important for the patient. And it is the dependence of the patient on the resources of the medical doctors that creates the dependence. Because otherwise, what is dependent? Of course, a patient also may depend on a treatment or on a disease. That's something on itself. But for example, if I may give some example of resources, two well-known resources are information and knowledge, two different things. Mm. Yes, it means also if you use these two, if you base the discussion on these two resources, it's clear that the dependence depends from patient to patient and from situation to situation. When you go to a doctor, to a GP, general practitioner, with a cold, you need a prescription for medication, then you are dependent on the very specific resources of the doctor, which is his legal right to prescribe. You are not really dependent on the information of the doctor. You have a cold, you know that you have a cold.
But you need a paper for sick leave, for instance.
That's it. That's the legal the legal power of the doctor. In the case of a cold, the patient is not really dependent on the information of the doctor. Okay, the doctor will do his diagnosis and he will confirm. In the case of a patient with a rare disease, the dependence on information and knowledge, which are two different things, becomes much more tangible.
Mm-hmm. So is this especially, the power and the resource dependence especially important in chronic diseases, or is this also acute situations?
Well, it's important in both of the cases, but of course the dynamics we are in are that if the objective is to empower patients, to give them as much as possible a sense of control over the resources, let's use the two resources, information and knowledge. What is typical for a chronic patient, that not all of them, but a lot of them, they become experts in their own disease. They are even expert in having the disease, yes? Which means that the dependence on the resource information of the doctor becomes less. Of course, there is, for example, a difference between the dependence in the situation of a general practitioner who is a generalist and an expert. The expert, it's almost impossible, or even, I would say, impossible for a patient to know as much about a disease and a treatment as a specialist, because he is a specialist, yes? It's a little bit easier when a patient specializes in his own disease towards a general practitioner, for example. There are, of course, other resources. The skills, for example, is a resource. Time is another resource. Attachment and affection are two resources related to the quality of the patient-caregiver relationship. So what is patient empowerment? Patient empowerment is what changes for a patient when he learns that he is confronted with a disease, and certainly when he's confronted with something serious, medically serious, that is that he becomes dependent. That makes sick. Patient empowerment, and that is the job, amongst others, of the doctor and the caregivers, is to restore the patient's sense of control and autonomy.
So a very important aspect, in my opinion, is that we shouldn't confuse patient empowerment with the know-it-all or the patient who is very we always say a patient who is very sure of himself,
vocal.
Very vocal, very yes. mouthy.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with being okay. vocal. You can be, as a patient, very vocal and at the same time totally disempowered. Yeah. You can stay in a hospital for a week because for your treatment, and you can may I call it like that? You could be a pain in the ass of all the caregivers, yes? And then you are so-called vocal.
So it's
empowered due to the fact that you're vocal? Not at all.
So what can doctors do to empower us? It's not about being confident to speak up, but it's other capacities. I guess what I have just a practical in mind from my own work as a dermatologist, we tell our patient, we will help you to become your own doctor for certain chronic skin diseases, where patients need to learn, according to their status of the skin, to apply different creams. And there are some situations where they can manage themselves if they
sure.
are empowered,
yes.
if
yes.
they are well-trained.
Yeah.
They know, okay, this is a mild, this is becoming a mild flare. I will use a different cream. They have a written treatment plan mm-hmm. where they know, okay, in this situation, I can do this.
Right.
And only if it gets out of hand, only if there's a more exacerbation, that they will then be able to quickly mm-hmm. access a doctor.
Yes.
Would that be an example for an empowerment?
Yeah, sure. I would like to say two things. One, it is also important to know that there is mutual dependence. The patient, too, possesses resources that are key to the doctor. Without the information of the patient, it would for a doctor be much more difficult to develop a diagnosis. Yes, attachment, affection are resources that can play a role in for the doctor, too. Time is also an important resource for the doctor, too. There is mutual dependence.
Time? Yeah. How do you explain it?
Well, you know, time, everybody who works in healthcare knows that there is a lot of time pressure due to the fact that the healthcare system, is much more focused on quantity than on quality, yes? A doctor today, or a healthcare organization, is paid due to the number of patients and the number of treatments. So when a doctor invests too much time in one patient, yes, you could simply say he loses money. So
he might go bankrupt and not be able to help anybody.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But that is a characteristic of the system. That's clearly, that is something that has to change. But there is mutual dependence, mm-hmm, yeah. which means that both have the possibility to exercise power. What is important is that it is in the advantage of neither of them to exercise the power. Why? For the patient. One, because the patient is of both actors, if I may call them like that, the most vulnerable. He is sick. He depends on the doctor. And two, for the doctor, because the research, included my own, confirms that the majority of all caregivers chose their job because they wanted to help people. Mm-hmm. Power, as Jan underlined, rightly underlined, is not the intention of doctors. So their objective is to do the best possible for their patients. So exercising powers goes against that.
Yeah,
to respond to your second element of the question, what could a doctor do? Since the conclusion of my research is that there is mutual dependence, but that the patient depends more on the resources of the doctor than vice versa, it is up to the most powerful of them to take the first step to the empowerment of the patient. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I have analyzed the process of patient empowerment, and I see three phases or three elements. One, it's of course exchanging information. Mm-hmm. The word exchange is extremely important. Go back 30, 40 years ago, and the information went in one direction. It was the doctor that informed the patient. Now the doctor has to listen to the patient. They have to listen to each other and understand each other's perspectives. Second phase is exchanging arguments, influencing each other in an open way, is saying, why is this treatment acceptable to you? Why not? Including the values of the patient. The third phase is deciding together. And then the third phase has a supplementary element, is strengthening the self-efficacy of the patient. And the self-efficacy means the fact that a person is convinced that he is able to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And the three phases are together. Just informing the patient doesn't equal patient empowerment. Mm-hmm. It's an important condition. Just exchanging arguments is not empowering. It is also deciding together. And then that second element of the third phase, self-efficacy, that is linked to your question.
Okay.
Because you can have a patient that is well-informed. He exchanged argument or she exchanged arguments with the doctor. He knows or she knows why a certain treatment is the best treatment possible. He understands his disease. He's convinced that a certain treatment is needed. The doctor and the patient together said, is that what we are going to do? And the patient says, yes, I'm convinced that is the right thing to do. And the patient could step out of the consultation room and think, I'm convinced, but I'm not able to do it. And therefore, certainly in a societies in our country, West European countries, where the focus should go from cure to care, mm-hmm. and to more treatment and self-management of diseases, this self-efficacy is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And self-efficacy, being convinced that you are able to follow and to strengthen the treatment, is something that you cannot do by domination or coercion. You have to have the patient as a partner in the process. It will never work without it.
I think so. Your theories fit very well in what also comes from other science, where we say the shared decision making as a process. And interestingly, now there comes all the outcome research, where there's a change in thinking that doctors, care organizations, payers, etc., that they are interested, how good are our outcomes? Are we really doing good things to the patient, things that the patient wants or that are of importance for the patients? And I think the process that you just described is the way to achieve the best outcomes.
Yeah, and what is important is to say is that it is not a free choice. Certainly in our Western European countries, where we underline the importance of individual freedom, of participation, of involvement of people, of citizens. Look at all the feedback we get and the reaction demonstration on the climate issues. You have to involve people if you want to convince them that what we do is the best to do. Certainly, when it's related to their own healthcare, we all know that unhealthy behavior, I could identify two main problems. Unhealthy behavior, between 60% and 80% of of diseases are related to unhealthy behavior, which means the diseases could be prevented or avoided. So how can you solve that problem without involving the patients? Mm-hmm. Yes,
I hear you, Edgar. And if you look at the three elements that are important, like information, the deciding on the treatment, and self-assessment or self-treatment.
Self-efficacy.
Self-efficacy,
yes.
I absolutely agree. But we can't deny the reality that in any healthcare industry, I'm not talking about general practitioners, but hospitals, it's 15 minutes per patient.
Yeah.
So who are you going to hit with a waffle iron and change this?
Well, I think there is... We agree in certainly in Belgium healthcare, but in the most healthcare system in Europe, that the system has to change. Yes, what we saw the last years is a huge trend to more accreditation, to more processes and procedures. And I think the basic objective of all these systems is quite okay. It's more patient safety. It's more, and that is important. But we are now at a point where we start to follow the side effects of it. And what is important is that, you know, the fact that we know that most of the caregivers in our West European countries are motivated to help people, this goodwill of caregivers is endangered today due to the expansion of systems and procedures that maybe almost become the objective instead of the final objective that should regroup us all, that is having the best final result for the patients. So the system, and that is why it is important when you talk about patient empowerment to integrate all levels. We did talk about the interpersonal level, what I could call the micro level up to now. But I've identified in my study also resources on the meso level, healthcare, and the macro level, society. Mm-hmm. Let's take a resource on the societal level, the bureaucracy, yes?
Of course, that's administration, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, there is direct link between bureaucracy, what the minister does on the level of society, and what happens on the micro level. You know, when a patient gets reimbursement for a certain medication, it is decided by the minister on the level of the society, mm-hmm. which means that we will only achieve total patient empowerment, also always at the condition that the patient wants it. We should come back on that. When you look at the dependencies of on the level of healthcare and on the level of society, which means that, for example, in a hospital, like in our own hospital in UZ Brussels, for example, that it's not just a matter of empowering a patient and giving a patient control in the patient-doctor relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a key relationship. Of course, that goes without saying. Mm-hmm. But in the whole hospital, how is the patient treated by administration? Mm-hmm. When he comes in on the parking and so on. I mean, everything, patient empowerment and giving the patient that sense of control and respecting an egalitarian relationship mm-hmm. should become part of the culture and the DNA of the organization.
Yeah, I think what you explain here, it summarizes perfectly the conflict that exists between the human, patient and doctor, and the system that they have to work in. And when I've written your I haven't written it, when I read your book, Edgar,
yes,
that was a small slip of the tongue. I was always thinking, like, yeah, I see the theory behind it, I understand it, I've experienced it myself as a patient. I've often felt also like a number, for example, that I didn't feel that my specialist or my doctor wasn't listening to me, so I could really really identify very easily with it. But in the end, if you work in a hospital, there is a whole machinery going on, and embedding the concepts of patient empowerment there, it's not something that we just can lecture to the new students who are studying medicine right now and say, guys, you have to make sure that your patient is empowered. We'll probably have to do a bit more.
You know, Bart, I agree, but you know, what we can spend our time by looking at each other. And we can, as individuals, look at the system and say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I will give you a concrete example, a very simple example, that not all aspects of patient empowerment are related to the system. I can tell you the story of Gertje, who has got a double breast amputation and a double breast reconstruction. Very serious. She was for the reconstruction in our hospital. She was lying in her hospital bed. The nurse came in her room at the end of her bed. The nurse looked in the eyes of Gertje. And the listeners won't see it. I now lay my hand on Jan's leg. that is what the nurse did. She laid the hand on Gertje's leg. She touched it as a kind of emotional reinforcement. And Gertje gives, they understood each other. And Gertje said, it took 5 seconds. It was strengthening me, and she understood what I was going through. That is not dependent on the system. Yes. So I agree, when you are talking about a resource like time, something has to change. But it is, you could translate the whole concept in a thousand concrete examples. How do you come in a patient room as a nurse? Do you knock, or do you just open the door because it's your working domain? Yes. How do you touch the body of a patient for the first time? Do you do it with respect? When you come in a patient room, do you use the first name of the patient, or do you ask the permission of the... That has nothing to do with the system. Being explaining the elements of an invoice so that the patient understands of the elements, that has nothing to do with this. But each hospital can do that. Each employee of the hospital can participate in empowering the patient.
I think you gave... When we talked another time, you had a very interesting example from a dermatologist, and about the explanation of potential risks of a small treatment.
Yeah, I even had two examples. An example where I was critical and a good example. And it's good to remind me. The first example was that I went to the dermatologist because I had a little, how do you call this?
I look at Jan now.
For now, we can call it a spot.
A little spot, yeah, a spot on my skin, on my face.
Just take an appointment to be sure after the podcast.
Yeah, okay, I do that. A little spot, but it has to be frozen, I think, yes. And because, of course, I'm doing some research on patient communication, when the doctor was almost starting freezing that little spot, I said, you know, doctor, does that have any side effects? And the doctor said, no, not as many as cancer. Yeah, but I understood. On the spot, I considered that a good answer, because what he did is who do you call this? He relativized, do you say this? The consequences of the little spot. What he was saying to me is, don't worry. I mean, it is that unimportant compared to what you could have if it would be skin cancer. I understand it. But what I was trying to do as a patient is to get all arguments to know why I was doing it. And what the doctor did by giving his answer is, he didn't give me arguments. When I went out of the consultation room and someone else would ask me, Edgar, why did you do it? Does it have side effects? I would be obliged to say, I don't know. Yeah. So, I mean, I was not a part in the process. No. It's an anecdote. Another thing was that that was the same dermatologist that I went to for a check. And it was a university hospital. There were a lot of trainees there, and there was a trainee, and the trainee started to look at my skin, and the doctor said, please ask the permission first before you touch the skin of the patient. And the trainee said, okay, you don't mind that I have a look at your skin and that I touch it? And I said, yes. That is it. That gives me a feeling of respect and of control. So two good examples.
That leads me to something that is I had in the back of my head during the whole podcast. But are there specific experiences you had that led you to becoming more specialized into patient empowerment?
Well, let me give you two examples. One first related to the skin issue that I had with my own mother. Yes, at a certain moment, I went met my mother. She passed away last year. She had Alzheimer's. But we went to a dermatologist in the Ghent area, and she had very red skin at the face, and she gave her a certain cream. She used it, and 3 weeks after that, after the treatment, we went back, and the red skin disappeared. Mm-hmm. I mean, the treatment worked really well. And I remember that I was sitting next to my mother, that the doctor knocked at the door next to her. Somebody else came out in a white
coat.
Yes. So I presume a doctor. She didn't present herself. She came to my mother. She, without saying anything, she touched the head of my mother in a very brutal way, looked at it, said, "Wow, this is a fantastic result," and she went away again. Yeah. And it's only when I was driving home with my mother that I said, God, this was really extremely unrespectful.
Were you feeling mad at that time? Or more
astonished, flabbergasted.
Upset.
It was very fast.
Yeah.
It goes. I'm not a very a reactive person in that field. I'm starting to think afterwards. And it was when I drove home that I said, "Oh God, what happened to us?" Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Another very concrete example. It seems that I have the. How do you call this in English?
The Adam's apple.
The slokdarm.
Esophagus. The esophagus.
Esophagus. Oh God.
That's why we have Jan here.
Yeah. Yes. I'm a doctor, but clearly not a medical doctor. I have a small issue there due to reflux. Yes. Yeah. And no worries. It's not cancer. Yes. But the whole process of first take medication to treat it and then take biopsies to see if there is cancer took 2-3 months, mm-hmm. with some very unpleasant
side effects of for the treatment.
Right. She knew, the doctor knew exactly the process that she was following. Mm-hmm. I know the process now, but I constricted it myself afterwards. What she first did is, let's treat what I see now. Then if the treatment is done, we take biopsies and then we will see this. Mm-hmm. She never told me that.
Okay.
So, I mean, if she would have said, that's what we are going to do. We are going to do this and this. Why? Mm. It's unpleasant, but we need to do it. Why do we need to do it? It has no side effects. That is why. You know, I have to take care of my food today. Yes?
Yeah.
Due to that. Nobody told me which food, not a GP, not a specialist, told me which food to avoid and which to take. They all said, you know, the medication is more important than the food. Okay.
But were there foods that you should have avoided?
Yes. And there are still foods that I should avoid. Okay, yes.
For me, there is a difference between not telling where you are in the process so that the whole treatment looks like a never-ending story and you start to become desperate and actually withholding knowledge because you're just forgetting to tell the patient that he shouldn't, I don't know, eat oranges or something.
Really? You can directly relate that to self-efficacy. I have a meeting now. A consultation foreseen with the dietists, mm-hmm. to have a look at it. Yes, but I got a very good treatment. It worked very well, and the doctor who treated me and did the research did a very good job. I was very happy with how it went. But they forgot self-efficacy. Mm-hmm. They forgot to involve the patient, to involve the patient that way that I come out of the treatment with a clear view on what I have, I've researched thanks to the help of Dr. Google.
So, Edgar, a lot of patient empowerment comes down to information, exchange of information.
It's one element of patient empowerment, yes. Yeah.
And so how about the internet, Dr. Google? Is it a very useful tool? Are there some dangers?
Well, it is. It's there and will remain. And it's, generally speaking, and potentially a very interesting information source. But there are certain criteria. You have to be able, first of all, you have to look for health information. A lot of people just use the internet for animation and not for intellectual issues. Secondly, you have to know how to find it. You have to know how to judge the information. And then you have to dispose of the needed literacy to discuss about it with your specialist or doctor, yes? And there the doctor plays an important role, because I refer to a doctor publishing in his waiting room a poster saying, "Don't mix up Dr. Google with my medical knowledge." I understand the reaction, but it's a bad reaction, because you stimulize patients not to tell their doctors that they looked for information on the internet. Mm-hmm. And what is important is for a doctor is to know what the patient knows. And certainly with the internet, because you can read a lot of wrong things and misinformation, sometimes voluntary created wrong information and so-called fast facts on the internet. If you don't know that the patient read them, you, during the consultation as a doctor, you think you are communicating in an adequate way with your patient, but the patient has something else in mind. So it is potentially a very useful form, but it's conditional.
So I think there are many quite good websites available, for instance, from medical societies, where a lot of information is prepared for patients,
yes,
and somehow cross-checked and validated, mm-hmm, by specialists. So I totally agree. I think it's a good source.
Research shows that most of the people are not looking at the source of the internet information. Mm. So what caregivers have to do is direct themselves to the trusted websites and the trusted sources on the internet. Avoid that a patient has to look himself, but tell him, if you want to know more, go to this site. And not doing what you should never do, say, don't look at the internet. Mm-hmm. That is a stimulus for patients to go there. And to look at the internet. Mm-hmm.
So, Edgar, you've worked a lot about patient empowerment in the last years. What would you identify as the main benefits of patient empowerment in general?
Well, I think you could summarize it in two ways. One, the fact that it makes the patient a real partner in his healthcare, which is a real condition, compliance, or what we call today adherence to a treatment, is and remains a big issue. How can you expect a patient to follow the treatment if he has not been involved in the development of the treatment and the decision about the treatment? So this is an extremely important element. Secondly, the result of healthcare is a result of both. It's a matter of trust. It's about trust, the trust of the patient in the doctor, in his knowledge, in his goodwill, in the fact that he has the best intentions, and the trust of the doctor in his patient, that he knows that the patient will do his best to follow the treatment. You can only achieve that if you are sitting in the same boat and going unseen in the same direction. Mm-hmm. A third element is that I think it will also avoid difficult discussions with caregivers. You know, when a doctor tells a patient, don't discuss about it, simply do it now, that's the best for you, The problem is that if there is a problem afterwards, it is, of course, the mistake and the fault of the doctor, because the patient was not involved in the decision-making. So, I mean, informed decision-making creates shared responsibility, which leads to the best results. So, and then again, in a phase where we need more self-management and prevention, I mean, patient empowerment, of course, the problem is empowerment puts in its in the words a focus on power, and my conclusion is avoid power. Remain in a communication mood. Discuss, communicate, inform each other, discuss about it, learn to know each other, learn to understand each other's perspectives and decide together with respect for each other's point of views and values. That is the best respect. So patient empowered, in fact, is sharing control and avoiding power, the exercise of power.
Is there in the end? I have a bit of that being mainly a human advantage, a human benefit,
yes, of
feeling
course.
Better, which will result to a better health, or is it also an economical benefit? Both are probably linked.
You know, it's what I'm saying is not just a matter of healthcare. Mm-hmm. It is something that we should look at how, in our West European countries, how politics are developed. And the huge distance between politicians today and citizens today. You know, when I've, in my research, there was a quantitative part, mm-hmm. and I've asked, and 3,051 participants filled in a questionnaire, mm-hmm. and I asked to order 10 professions. I ask you, Bart, mm-hmm. a doctor, a scientist, a fireman, a politician, a journalist, were 5 or 6 of this 10.
Yeah.
Which of the ones I nominated had was considered as the less trustful?
The politician?
Yeah. The doctor was the first.
The most trustful
okay. of the 10.
All right.
Yes? Yeah. Which means that it is a problem in our society. And people want to be involved in what happens about them, in what politicians decide. But it has to be real involvement. The same goes with a healthcare organization and a hospital. You don't only ask patients if they are satisfied. My position is that everything you do for patients, that you have to involve patients, just as politicians have to involve the citizens, not just ask them every 2 years or 4 years to vote and then to say, okay, now we have asked their opinion and we can work for 3 or 4 years. No. Everything you do have to be done with the people concerned, involved.
Edgar, we are having now an international audience. I mean, you did your research in Northern Europe, in Belgium, but hierarchies, leadership styles differ a lot across cultures. Are the results of your research also applicable in Asia? Are they different in Africa? Is it different in Northern or Southern America? Is this some ubiquitous worldwide, or is this different in various cultures? Is there any research about this?
Yes, I would say that you could split up my research in two parts. What I first did is develop a concept and an alternative, a different way to look at the patient-caregiver relationship, and applied it in Belgian healthcare. The application of the concept, of course, is typically for Belgium, for the Flemish part of Belgium, and for the patient-general practitioner relationship. But the concept of looking at relationships and healthcare from a point of view of dependence remains and is applicable on every system. Of course, I applied it in a society where individual freedom is considered very important. In other cultures, the community is much more important. Someone who is religious will say, you know, I have in control, there is something above us that has control over us. This differs, the results of the analysis will differ. But the way to look at it will remain. It is important to understand that there is a form of power that is the result of dependence and that influences the way people behave. And what is important is that it is, compared to that classic where we started with, classic definition of power domination, you can see domination. You can observe it. The power of dependence is something that is not always observable. Because a patient that needs sick leave goes to his doctor and he has in mind, I would like a week sick leave. And the doctor says, this patient maybe once a week, but I only want to give 2 days. And there is a kind of negotiation between them. None of them will formally say, I don't want to give you a week, and the patient won't say, I want a week. There are exceptions. There is a negotiation. They depend on each other. So it influences the consultation without that it is always tangible. So to understand the dynamics is extremely important. Mm. You know, the Netherlands have the image of the Dutch people have the image of being very vocal, yes?
Yeah.
But they are as dependent, for example, on doctors as we are. So, I mean, there is, again, that difference between being vocal and being dependent, yeah. And so between being empowered. So I think the principles are applicable to every system, yeah. But the results will be different.
When you've written your book, I saw that you referenced a few sources, also from outside of Belgium, I think.
Yeah, sure, of course.
When was if I remember well, it's not the concept is not that old of patient empowerment.
What is typical when you read the literature? I mean, the fact that the patient has to be a partner in his own healthcare is old. Yeah. That point of view is old. But may I be very brutal, we never really did it. And what you feel now is that there is a momentum today. There are people in society, the request for more participation, to being more involved, is much more tangible than it was 10 years ago. That's why I'm saying patient empowerment, involving the patient as a real partner, is not anymore a free choice. It is something, and it is a humanitarian issue. How can we defend that we decide things about the lives of other people without involving these people? I'm sorry, I cannot defend that point of view.
I think it has also developed into a really interesting part of medical sciences. When you think the time back, there was a time when there was anatomy. It had to be discovered how our body is composed, muscles, bones, how do they interact with each other. And there came the time of the microscope, and the tissues were analyzed and the organs were analyzed. And then there came the physiology. We started to understand how we are breathing and how the blood pressure is interacting with breathing.
Indeed, yes.
So the medical research is an evolution. And then there comes the immunology part, how we suddenly see how defense against tumors, defense against pathogens, homeostasis of our body is tightly regulated. And a lot of, in the last years, we have seen drugs which in a miraculous way are suddenly curing diseases, or at least keeping diseases with almost no symptoms, which when I studied medicine, we didn't know where it came from and we had no sufficient treatment. And now in the last years, we suddenly see this new wave of science coming in, where we see the way how we care, how we perform care, not only the doctors, the nurses, everybody in the process, it starts with making an appointment, that this also has an impact on the outcome. Sure. Yeah? And I think this is very interesting that it is not only about molecules and it's not only about new gene therapies. We can have the best gene therapy. If you don't empower your patient and have a good decision to go for a treatment, yes or no, you will not have good outcomes.
Yeah. You could summarize by saying it's not because, medically speaking, something is possible that it should be done or should be applied. Mm-hmm. That is up to the patient if he wants it to decide. The patient is the only person living the side effects and the effects of the treatment. He has to decide, or she has to decide, if he or she accepts these side effects. Yeah. We can think as specialists that something is the best for the patient, but there is only one person who can finally decide if that is the best for him, and that is the patient and his surroundings himself.
Mm-hmm. You are teaching about this at the Erasmus School in Brussels. Mm-hmm. Is it part of the official curriculum for medical studies, or is it a sort of optional course? How is it seen?
It's what they call a bachelor after bachelor, okay, which means it's not yet part of the... Mm-hmm. There are contacts with them, mm-hmm, to make it part of the basic training, mm-hmm, and it should be. It should be, mm-hmm, I think, really in all trainings of doctors, mm-hmm, nurses, and all caregivers trainings. Why? Because, I mean, it's what people are trained to have control, and they have to learn that they have to share control with the patient. Yeah. And that is something that has to be learned. That means that, for example, in hospital where you have mentors of trainers, trainees, that they have to give the good example. Yes. So it has to be learned. Existing caregivers have to unlearn to have total control.
It's not that we haven't thought about it before, but it's a relatively new, or let's say at least it is relatively new to look at this in a scientific way. Yeah. And to get it into the scientific mainstream also of medical schools, of hospitals, to talk about it. Yeah. The good news is that communication nowadays is taught in the medical studies or in the continuous education that follows the basic graduate school. And it's even become part of the practical examinations of medical students to judge also their way of interactions with the patient. But I think it's still some way to go to get it universally to that level that
because we would like to communication have it. Is, for me, a tool to achieve patient empowerment. Communication is not still patient empowerment, because through communication you could also take control away from a patient. It is share and control. But you know, it is a positive story, because who has the, in whose advantage is my story? It is in the advantage of as well patients as caregivers. It's not an attack against patients who are too vocal or doctors who are too paternalistic. Mm-hmm. My conviction is it is the best result for both of them. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Together, an egalitarian relationship in mutual respect to achieve together the best healthcare for the patient. That is the story. So it is a positive story.
Yeah, very nice story. And I think it's also a very interesting story that is worthwhile to be shared with an international audience. This being said, you've written a book about it, Patient Empowerment, in Dutch.
In Dutch.
So you can go home now and translate it into English, because I think we will have some requests for that. It's definitely something that is worthwhile of continuing the research on. But I also wanted to talk about the association that you have put up in Belgium. The patientempowerment.be is the URL, but mm-hmm, it's also the website is also in Dutch. But just the fact that you have started up an association to create awareness around it, I just wanted to mention this on the podcast.
Because that's very kind.
It's very
and on my website, edgareekman.be, you have all information on the research too.
All right, I'll put the links in the description of this episode of the podcast. And Edgar, I hope that you'll get some feedback from our audience.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Oh yeah, no, it was absolutely really nice to come back to us and talk about this very interesting subject. Jan, maybe some last words for Edgar.
Yeah, thank you, Edgar. It was
You're very welcome.
A second very pleasurable hour to discuss this with you. And I think you will not have much spare time left because you will have now not only Dutch talks, but you will have to share a story in English. I think, thank you very much. And I hope we will get some feedback and hear whether people enjoyed it.
The more I can share the views on patient empowerment, also on international podium, the better.
Okay, thank you very much, Jan.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.